Welcome to the Blunt Business here on CannabisRadio.com. Thank you for joining us. Wherever you find the show, whether it's from the website CannabisRadio.com, the CannabisRadio.com app, which you can find in the Google Play Store and through iTunes, and of course, where you find podcasts, whether it be Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, YouTube Music, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, and so many other platforms. Blunt Business is powered by TheBuzzCRM.com. I wanted to give you a couple of frequently asked questions that some of our listeners have when they hear about me giving out this sponsorship. Well, you hear there's going to be all these webinars we're going to be doing under the hood, which very soon you'll get a chance to get an exclusive look at how the Buzz CRM's 500-plus marketing tools, AI-powered automation, and personalized workflows can revolutionize your business. And the AI features we have available. You can assist with copywriting with the Ask Brandy AI feature, making content creation a breeze, and a chatbot widget in action, scheduling appointments, and making sales easy while you're away. And when it comes to the Buzz CRM connecting you with customers, you'll find out about omnichannel reach, showing how you can connect with customers. You get your own sales team at your disposal with SMS, email, and social media available at your fingertips. And you'll also see advanced analytics so you know exactly what's working and what's not. And is the Buzz CRM right for your business? It's one size fits all. A low barrier to entry, affordable and comprehensive for various industries. If you want to get rid of marketing tools that are just a conundrum, it's just a clutter that you're holding on to, too many passwords, then find one place that will take care of everything for you. 500 modules under one platform. TheBuzzCRM.com. TheBuzzCRM.com. Learn more and go ahead and sign up for that today. With me today on the program is a leading authority in cannabis law and the co-chair of Fox Rothschild's LLP's cannabis law practice. He's ranked by Chambers USA among the nation's top cannabis law attorneys, advising industry giants like PharmaCann and Trulieve on complex commercial transactions, regulatory compliance, and market access in the rapidly evolving cannabis and hemp sectors. His national team in 2021 was named Cannabis Group of the Year by Law 360. I'm here with Joshua Horn. Josh, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Apologies if I haven't had you on sooner, because it's been since 2018 since we had you on, and that was back when President Trump was in office and first term and was looking into considerations about rescheduling cannabis back then in 2018. But we'll get to that a little bit later on the program. But first, I want to get on to you about the recent goings on in California, because there's a lot that's happening there. Initially, as of July 1st, and regardless of whatever was being done by lawmakers, a 25% California cannabis tax is going to be put into effect as of July 1st. We're recording the day before. So with this, we know the legal cannabis industry has been struggling. I have talked about it extensively on the program with various operators, with attorneys, and with various other people talking about compliance, the issues of the illicit market, which have been rampant for years, and the more importantly, just the amount of taxation that's already put onto this market anyways. And there's always these thoughts, well, there might be something more into grants being brought into this, into the mix. I mean, look, Governor Newsom's already had enough trouble trying to keep Hollywood in California as it is with all the movie production moving outside of the state. What about cannabis? Is it going to be what Hollywood's doing right now?
Well, I think imposing additional taxes really not a good idea. I mean, you've had a historic issue in California with oversupply and under demand, and part of that oversupply is the illicit market. And if you're going to tax the companies that are in the highly regulated market even more, it's only going to draw people to the illicit market, I think, even more than that. Because ultimately the additional taxes are going to be passed along to the consumer in some fashion. And so, you run into a circumstance where, you know, a consumer's going to get same product, for a lot less money. And so I think it's really going to be damaging to the industry in California.
And if I'm correct, it's over $1 billion in tax revenue that the state already gets. I don't know what's being squandered. But then again, California's also had issues with their own budget deficit. And my thing is just that with the size of the market that it is, and there's always been issues within the market, you would think, with it being one of the largest markets there is, and being what would be a role model for states like New York or Illinois to go ahead and implement their own cannabis programs, adult use, that has not been much of a help for them at all. But the thing is, it's taxation above and beyond for everything that's going on there. I mean, is it just that cannabis is not being isolated? It's just part of the taxation that continues on in this state.
Right. Well, California has historically been probably the most highly taxed state. And this is just the kind of part and parcel of, I mean, like, for example, I mean, to get a, to fill up your tank, forget what gas. I mean, it's prohibitively expensive. And I suspect a fair amount of that is because of the tax structure in California. So overtaxing and under delivering, to the consumers, I just don't think is a very good business model. But by the same token, if you're holding a license in California, you know, other than shutting your doors, what else can you do? I mean, hopefully you have very good lobbyists working in Sacramento to try to get the governor or the legislature to revisit what they're doing. But, you know, you give up your business or you try to do the best you can. I think in the end of the day, those businesses are going to be materially damaged. And look, I mean, there's risk to the consumer buying product in the gray market. You don't really know what you're getting. And in the fear of we have with fentanyl, for example, throughout the country. I mean, this is a real concern. And I don't think the government has really taken a particularly jaundiced eye to what they're doing, because they're exposing businesses to failure and they're exposing the consumers to, you know, potential health problems and risks. And I'm sure it wasn't their intention.
No, but also at the same time, the illicit market that may be out there as well. At the same time, well, there might be other illicit drugs that are out there like fentanyl that are coming in. There's also not enough of the illicit market being cracked down. I guess they'll remember in 2018, the New York Times reporting about that and talk about, even though, you know, sheriff's offices and the law enforcement community there can try to go and crack down as much as they have, they are limited on resources and limited on trying to go and be able to crack down on those illicit operations. But let's break down into the taxes themselves. And I want to just refresh the audience on this, because we talked about the breakdown of the taxes that are affecting cannabis businesses in California. So this current state cannabis excise tax is being put into effect on July 1st, unless there's some last minute Hail Mary, which there was something that looked like there might be, but nothing happened. Tax increases will be 15 to 19% of gross receipts from retail sales. And that's on top of the statewide rate of 7.25%. With other variations depending on local district taxes. So cities and municipalities that also will tax as well, and the local government cannabis business taxes. And all these areas, including whatever permits might need to be done, collecting remaining taxes to proper authorities, and also the cost for maintaining accurate records. This is overkill. And we've seen many companies, you know, MSOs, that are going to have to find their way out of Canada, you know, out of California to go to other markets. And I remember the talk about where Governor Newsom would, you know, in kind, a nice gesture to say, well, you might consider regional interstate commerce, but that's only after, you know, if cannabis was rescheduled or decriminalized or legalized nationwide. Again, this, he is not helping at all. What's the modus operandi here? Because the same thing goes here. It's just, is it just the protocol of just saying, well, this is just how, you know, it's the policies in this particular political environment in California, this is just the way it's going to continue on. And when they can't make enough money, they're going to continue to tax the public.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly, I would say that's a cynical view, but I certainly share that cynical view.
I'm always cynical, yeah.
It is, in my view, it's just the money grab. I mean, look, a lot of states have budget shortfalls and they, you know, you have an option. What are your options? Your options are, do you, for example, increase real estate tax and make up for the budget shortfall? Or do you tax cannabis where, you know, it's everyone has a choice. No one has to buy it. No one has to smoke it. No one has to do anything with it. And so I think from a political expedience thing, I mean, if you were to ask every landowner in California, would you rather be taxed more for the services that the state is trying to provide? Or would you rather have something like alcohol, tobacco, gaming, cannabis taxed? I think it's a no-brainer what people would say.
Yeah.
And so I think this is in facing budget shortfalls, this is what you're faced with. And so, and I think part of why I think it's particularly myopic is the tax burden on these companies is already tremendous because of Internal Revenue Code 280E. Mm-hmm. And so this is just
you know, the profit margins are already razor thin. And, you know, I suspect this would probably destroy those profit margins altogether. So if you were, you know, if you're a licensee and you're still and you're struggling now, why would you stay?
No. And the most important thing is that while they continue to go ahead and tax on the legal operators, you have legal operators that are shutting down in the thousands. Mm-hmm. Retail stores struggling to pay the existing tax rate before it increases. But also at the same time, where is the state of California and law enforcement being able to go and crack down on illegal cannabis farms, illegal stores that are thriving? And the estimate has been said, this is according to SF Gate, a recent article, that more than 60% of all sales are illicit market. That is mind-blowing. And that tells you everything. You can't even go ahead and crack down on the majority of sales illicitly, but then you want to go ahead and keep picking away at those of the 40% of sales that are out there. Doesn't make any sense. The math does not compute.
No, it doesn't. And if you think about all the licensees, I mean, everyone listening to this broadcast will know, I mean, the burden, the regulatory burden on those companies to just even function on a daily basis is such an inherent cost of doing business. And where you have, you know, the illicit market in Northern California, you know, being cannabis throughout the state, and it's, you know, law enforcement, either they're understaffed, under-resourced, or they're just not focused on it, or they're more concerned about violent crime. And so if there's not violent crime associated with the illicit sale of cannabis, I suspect you're just not interested. I don't think you have overabundance of interest from the federal government either. I mean, you don't hear about, when I was younger, I remember hearing, oh, these big busts, you know, get reported on the news. You don't hear that anymore. Because I just don't think there's just so many other fish to fry, to use the hackney term, but there's no interest unless there's violence. Yeah. And when there's violence, I think maybe it's different. Or if there's evidence of, you know, cross-border cartels, maybe you have greater attention. It is a floundering prospect that you're going to overtax people who are trying to do it the right way. And if they don't do it the right way, irrespective of whether they want to stay in business or tax, they can lose their licenses. Where somebody, you know, with a farm in Northern California has done it with impunity for 30 years and no one's going to stop them. No one ever has. So why would they stop now? And certainly the state of California doesn't seem to be making a real earnest effort to stop them.
It's unfortunate. At the very top, Governor Newsom, he's looking to do a presidential run. It's pretty clear of that. So when he finds the right moments, you know, whether it's the ICE raids in California a couple weeks ago and the riots that came of it, whatever opportunity he has to get in front of a camera at a story that will get national headlines, he will. But in this case here, when it comes to taking care of existing thriving, what would be thriving economies in California, it only was until the last minute that there's an increase in the grant money towards Hollywood when it comes to trying to go and compete with other movie studios or TV production to bring California and continue to have a business like that in this environment. Same thing with cannabis without, you know, let's go and do a pause on this particular tax increase, but that never happened. It's like, oh, we'll say, yeah. Well, if the pause is put in front of his desk, he'll sign it. But then we don't need pauses. We need a decrease, but there's nothing coming up with that. It's not even happening.
No, again, I don't think he's got an incentive to do anything. I mean, it's you know, there's, look, in my experience, you still run into people who just like, well, it's federally illegal. You know, we're not going to do anything to help. And then the sad part of it is, you know, for businesses to be effective in the space, your regulator, you know, either whoever the particular regulatory body is, or can it be the state that you're in, has to be your business partner. Mm-hmm. And a business partner putting its foot on your throat isn't a business partner.
No.
And I just don't get it. I think if there would have been a serious analysis of the industry as it currently sits, the fact that MSOs are leaving California and other states that are similarly faced with these types of bizarre taxes or management of the industry, I mean, they're going to lose money ultimately.
Oh, yeah. And they're losing businesses, they're going to go somewhere else. But right. And that's such a shame that California's got to go through this route. But I mean, again, they're allowing so much business, so many residents leaving the state as well. When that's one of the best states that we would love to be at viably for if the economic climate was changed and so many other things would be changed. People want to be in California. This is not the choice. Oh, we just got to leave because, you know, we don't need any more reason to leave. It's so horrible here. But people want to live there, you know, optimally. People would like to go and make that state a place to thrive like it was once before. But, you know,
well,
the thinking is not prevailing that way.
Well, and the other thing I think people lose sight of, particularly, which is it's not just, okay, you're taxing the licensed cannabis industry. But what's the collateral damage? I mean, what about all those other businesses that don't touch the flower,
right,
that are servicing these businesses? You know, companies, landlords who own the real estate, REITs that own the real estate, vendors who supply nutrients for a grow facility.
Yeah.
I mean, if you keep going down the line, there's going to be a ripple effect throughout the economy by imposing a tax burden. And then, you know, when these companies shut and they have all these vendors who aren't paid, what's going to happen there?
No, you know,
people aren't going to get paid. It's just not a good. It's a recipe for disaster. It's not a recipe for success. I just think it's penny wise, pound foolish.
Right. We're going to go to commercial break. When we come back, we're going to talk a bit about all the goings on when it comes to FDA rescheduling, because we haven't seen any movement from it. But there are some things happening right now within Capitol Hill where we're going to get some investigations about this. The GOP wants to go and investigate what happened with this whole process where President Biden made a point to the Health and Human Services Director recommending to the DEA that cannabis be rescheduled. So we saw this, and we've been chronicling this story right here on Blunt Business. We're going to go ahead and follow up more with Joshua Horn here from Fox Rothschild. He is attorney at Fox Rothschild, leading authority in cannabis law and co-chair of the cannabis law practice here on Blunt Business. We'll be back after a short break. Welcome back to Blunt Business. I'm here with Joshua Horn, attorney at Fox Rothschild in their cannabis law practice. So, Josh, we've been...
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Following along since 2023 about the direction, just looking at the timeline of the possible FDA rescheduling, which is now at a pause. There's been a lot been reported on this. I want to just go through real quickly of the timeline we've been following along ever since. August 2023. So we're coming up on 2 years now. HHS was recommended to DEA that marijuana be rescheduled from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3. Then proposed rulemaking the following year. DEA accepting public comments and requests for hearings. And then we had a hearing postponed of January of this year that was due to an appeal. There was a lot of issues. Perkins Coie was involved, and it was just who was being representing in the case. And the administrative law judge, John Mulrooney, was supposed to be going along with this. But right now we have a 60 days a congressional review to either delay or advance it. And of course, we had change in administration since then, but we all thought, you know, with the Biden administration's recommendation, thank you for doing this, Mr. President. We were happy for this, but whatever held this down and slowed everything down is an issue. But at the moment, we know that it continues to be paused despite President Trump right now is supporting, and he's been supported since 2018. He looked at the idea, at least of medical marijuana, and I remember going back to see, and this is regardless of the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, the Cole memo. Let's look past that, folks. But there was a point where he absolutely said, if the States Act, which was the act that Senators Elizabeth Warren and Cory Gardner had both co-signed, they co-wrote the bill, if it was brought to his desk, then he would go and sign it. It was the same thing as goes. We could have gotten to this a long time ago, but it never was because of so much issues right now in Congress. Listen, we now have the one big beautiful bill that's being put up. The GOP has, it looks like, just a very slim razor thin majority that might be able to get this passed before the end of this week. But either which way, the rescheduling, we know, has been administratively paused by a DEA judge. at this moment, I was waiting to see if something might happen with a new DEA director, which I know is another Terrence Cole. They're trying to bring him in. But I think there's been something in the nomination process where he has not been confirmed yet. I don't know where that is yet, but there's not a lot of writing about this. But is there anything you could tell me that you're learning about on the ground that is any movement towards investigating or finding out why are we still stuck in this pause some 6 months later?
I have not heard anything granular as to what's going on. I mean, we had been involved in those hearings, and I participated on a pro bono basis. I just think the political environment, and not pointing fingers at either party, it's just not there. I mean, there's so many other problems that I just think, and I think this part is some partisan politics because nobody wants, you know, Biden to be perceived to have gotten a victory on a big issue.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, the president was pretty outspoken about, for just use, for example, about Florida's referendum in the fall for adult use, and he supported it. And so, but at the same time, it's my understanding that the person who was nominated to be the head of DEA is anti-reform. And so it's very confusing. And I think, sadly, there's partisan politics on both sides of the aisle when they don't get out of their own way, nothing happens. And I think that's what you're faced with here. Nothing.
But I believe in the hearings, I don't think he said anything when he was asked about it. He didn't necessarily have any kind of a opinion about it. He was vague about it. He never gave any kind of opinion at all.
Nor would he. I wouldn't expect he would have, because anything like that you put in a hearing and in a record can expose, you know, to appellate review, that it's an improper consideration, just hypothetically speaking. I mean, so it doesn't shock me that there was silence other than just saying we're putting on an administrative hold, which, you know, quite frankly, he can renew that hold as he desires. And I suspect that will happen. I suspect that nothing will happen until we have an appointed and confirmed head of the DEA. And then at that point, you know, all bets are off. I mean, I've always been cynical about it, flipping back to 280E. I mean, if you think about it, what incentive does the federal government have true cannabis reform in this country? If you figure that, unlike a regular business, such as a law firm like mine, where because of all the deductions you can take, maybe you're paying tax on 55 cents on the dollar. But in the cannabis business, because of 280E, it's like 90, 95 cents. Cents on the dollar. And so why would the federal government have any incentive to reschedule when that windfall goes away? I mean, that's a particularly cynical view, but it just doesn't seem to be any momentum. I mean, everybody thought safe banking was going to happen a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And it's had bipartisan support historically throughout the House, and it's dead on arrival at the Senate.
Well, I mean, they did try some things. I mean, the thing is, I don't want to go ahead and discredit that the Biden administration did not make attempts. They did try to go and expunge federal convictions, but that really doesn't take care of the bulk of the convictions that are out there.
Right.
Then there was the part where they tried to embed the Safe Banking Act. I think it was into the Defense Authorization Act. They tried to embed it in there. They were trying to find ways to get it in somehow. It wasn't necessarily putting it out in front. They were doing a support, but they were trying to do something to give a carrot, at least to the voter base, and also to the gun, say, hey, here's a win. And I actually honestly thought that if the Biden administration, through the HHS and FDA, if they were to go and get the rescheduling done, that was a major win that could have helped Biden's reelection campaign. But then everything changed, and then, you know, the change at the top of the ticket, all that happened. So we never got to that. And, you know, I bet you Kamala Harris probably would have benefited from it and probably would have, you know, could have piggybacked off of that, maybe even though she wasn't really part of it.
Right. Certainly the younger vote, I think, was very supportive. And I think every national poll you see, a not insignificant majority of people want cannabis reform.
Bipartisan, by the way, too.
Yeah, bipartisan, for sure. I mean, even take my state where I reside, I'm in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, which, you know, you have more progressive sides of both sides of the state, and in between it's very conservative. And Senator Federer, when he lieutenant governor, he went to every county to get a sense of whether residents in every county were supportive of cannabis reform in Pennsylvania to have an adult use program. And the consensus was all but two counties supported it. I mean, and I think that's the national tenor that people, again, my view is this is no different than gambling or smoking or drinking. I mean, it's another regulated industry, and that nobody's forcing anyone to do anything. And so it just doesn't make any sense other than politics.
You know what? I got to ask about Pennsylvania real quick. I'm going to be just going off of this tangent because I don't know if you're familiar with the fact that on Cannabis Radio, we host a podcast with the state senator in Pennsylvania, Sharif Street, who's one of the co-authors of trying to get adult use legalization into Pennsylvania. And it's all a matter of assembly has to go and come in, put a bill in front, and then make it where, you know, Governor Shapiro can go ahead and sign it. It's just as simple as that. Not any kind of amendment or any kind of ballot initiative that's necessary. And it was a couple of months ago, we actually had House Bill 1200, and we talked to Representative Rick Kujewski, about this. And it was a bill that did pass the House, got the Senate committee, got shot down a Senate committee. But one of the areas that was really interesting about this part was there was community reinvestment, obviously, expungement processes that were included in the bill's components, but also the retail model of using the state-run stores, the alcohol stores that the state runs. I was just wondering what your thought about all that and where they were in that direction, especially when it's so much different of a layout than what, let's say, New York, New Jersey, or California are doing.
Yeah, the first thing if folks listening to this broadcast have to understand is Pennsylvania's state-run liquor control system. So you can't buy liquor other than in a state-run state store. You can't buy beer in a state store. That's handled differently. You can buy wine in supermarkets, but it's not fine wine, if you will. And so, you know, most of the people I've spoken with always knew that was going to be dead on arrival to put it in a state liquor control system from the retail space, but that from a political standpoint, it was done because it may be more palatable when it gets to the Senate from a negotiation standpoint to remove that as opposed to not having it in there, then what's left to negotiate about. I mean, that's just one point of view that it was a negotiating tool. Now, the way it's working in Pennsylvania, they're trying to do it through the budget process, and the budget process ends today. But it can be extended. And there is growing bipartisan support. I mean, even Republican state senators who were traditionally opposed to it, you know, some have come around on it because, again, Pennsylvania, like most states, budget shortfall. COVID gave us a nice budget shortfall. And so what are your options?
Right. Well, you know what was interesting about that Senate committee was that several Democrats voted no on pushing the bill forward. So even there within the, you know, within the camaraderie there is of the Democratic Party in Pennsylvania, there is a bit of a change. But we know politically there's also a bit of a change in direction of what the Democratic Party is, either by state or by a national vote. We're going to come back, and I want to just make sure if people want to hear more about what was going on in Pennsylvania, we've been doing a lot of coverage on that. Planting Seeds with Sharif Street, that's our podcast here on Cannabis Radio. You can find all past episodes right here, cannabisradio.com and the Cannabis Radio app. Make sure to go listen to that. I'm going to come back here with Joshua Horn to talk more about the federal end of the cannabis rescheduling. And what I want to find out more is where there is possible investigations coming up forward and also some tampering within where the former White House drug czar, Rahul Gupta, is making the claims that there were some things that were being made to sabotage this whole plan. We'll talk all about that here after a short break again. I'm here with Joshua Horn, a co-chair of the cannabis law practice at Fox Rothschild. Here on Blunt Business, we'll be back after a short break. I'm back with final questions with Joshua Horn, co-chair of the cannabis law practice at Fox Rothschild LLP, and website is foxrothschild.com, Fox, RothschildCom. Now, I want to get back into what was going on with the cannabis rescheduling issues. Because there's been stories talking about right now, a GOP-led congressional panel earlier this month, as we're recording, is demanding an investigation on the rescheduling process. Let me get one thing that was brought in here, that the former White House drug czar, Rahul Gupta, make sure I say that correctly. He told the New York Times that there was internal resistance in the DEA to rescheduling, and that it was being they were trying to torpedo the Biden administration's efforts. And despite recommendations and also Attorney General Merrick Garland approving this, DEA leadership stalled the process, raised suspect questions about the medical value of cannabis, a move critics called rig. So with all that said, now we move into June 2025, and there's a congressional panel being assembled right now citing deviations in mental health hazards. So they want to review, listen, everything on the Biden administration now is getting under review, obviously the auto pen thing and who was actually really in charge, because we really don't know everything that was going on there. But now the same thing goes here with what the DEA was doing to really is either ignorance or negligence or what. But what do you see it might be that was causing this, and why we're not in this any moving any further? We're just at a pause. Something happened before Trump's administration came into office. What was it?
Well, I think I'd be speculating. I mean, one school of thought would be that DEA really never wanted this because of their mission. It's contrary to their mission. And that, you know, I think both sides used this investigation process to beat the bushes to see if there's anything there when there may not be any there. I mean, I just don't know if collusion or not. I mean, I just think, you know, in this partisan world, nobody wants to give anyone else any sort of victory. And you know, I suspect, you know, I was always surprised when it came out that the DEA was relatively supportive of reform, because it's contrary to their mission. And so if there is collusion, I mean, it should be addressed appropriately. And if there is a crime, certainly, you know, a crime should be addressed. But it just feels to me intuitively that it's just part and parcel of this delay. You know, we can't have the hearings go forward because now we have to complete this investigation. And the investigation, if I had a guess, will just languish. And so nothing will happen. You have businesses to continue to go under, because without true cannabis reform, QADE is here to stay. You know, conventional banking services are limited. You know, banks were accepting, you know, deposits, you know, charge a handsome fee. I mean, all that stuff, nothing changes. And so, and that's just going to further damage the industry, which, you know, could be, you know, terrific money generator for every state that has a program. And so it just smells like another avenue for further delay, notwithstanding the fact that, you know, President Trump, like I noted earlier, at least during the election in Florida, was supportive of real cannabis reform there. So hopefully at some point when everyone goes through the machinations, whatever investigation there is or won't be, we'll get back to and have some sanity on both sides of the aisle and get real cannabis reform. So otherwise, when the industry is going to continue to struggle.
And there's so much, honestly, that was being researched and being done through HHS and DEA about where we were in, where we can get to a point where we can have these controlled substances, because if we already have an area, various states, and the majority of states right now, let's just get to the point where federal can go ahead and, you know, flip the switch, because part of it was there were so many different areas that, you know, the House Appropriations Committee wants to go and look at, becomes where it's the HHS Inspector General completed the report on the scheduling review and looking at various issues, also looking at the issues when it comes to cannabis and hemp, and, you know, looking at possible considerations of making sure that, you know, companies do not violate the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, which, again, all these things here, there are barriers in place. There are measures in place for industries like-minded where the cannabis industry can follow along. And then the same thing goes for the rescheduling process. I'd rather that the DEA go ahead and start controlling what's going on here instead of staying in this gray area where nobody can really know where they're going to go with it. No one can invest in it. Nobody knows the rules. And the hemp bill's been like this already for years. The same thing goes here with legalization from a federal level. It's just not anything that goes forward.
Yeah, I think the real players in this space crave regulation.
And they also want to look at psychedelics as well. Which it's all, sure. That's exactly where we want to go with it. So it's not as if they're pinpointing the right direction, but what's stalling? And that's what I don't get.
Yeah, well, that makes two of us. other than, you know, nobody wanting anyone to get a victory on something that everybody wants. And so it's paralysis by analysis. It's just nothing happens. And it's sad. And we're not talking about hemp necessarily, but, you know, real players in the hemp space want the loopholes closed because they want to have meaningful regulation, just like you have in every state with respect to traditional cannabis programs. I mean, if I go to my medical marijuana dispensary and buy something, I'm reasonably assured that it doesn't have something in it that I don't want to be in vaping or ingesting. And so the failure to do something meaningful puts the consuming public at risk and really hurts these businesses. And it's just there. Somebody has to be the adult in the room.
Yeah. I don't know what they're going to go with it next, but at the same time, we're just waiting. And there's been things that have been talked about constantly. One of the other areas that was talked about before as well was the Justice Department also moving forward with easing restrictions. But, you know, I saw Vice put a story out about it, but it was something from a year ago. There's no enthusiasm. There's no motivation, no momentum that says that we're going to get into rescheduling or safe banking. You know, and I thought we were going to be cautiously optimistic. I guess everybody was all talking about that, but, you know,
it's all noise.
It truly is.
That's all it really is becoming. It's just all noise. And as a result, nothing is going to get done. I mean, it's sad. I mean, I hope I'm wrong. But, you know, there's so many other things that this country is dealing with that I think is taking the attention away. And I'm not, you know, pointing fingers, of course, but there's just so much going on. It's just like, okay, well, this is like, you know, the ugly stepchild that nobody wants to talk to. And it's sad.
Right. Now, the other thing, too, is that we could also see if something happens going forward where lawmakers can move forward and say, okay, let's get past this big, beautiful bill. Whatever is going to happen with that. And if Congress can start passing bills, they can start moving along with things, that might be something we can go forward with. And I don't know where in the queue cannabis is, but if Congress starts operating better, there's been a lot of lag time for this all to happen. Maybe we can get somewhere.
Yeah. My concern is it's low because I think there's still an older demographic, more so in the Senate than in the House, that still sees cannabis as a gateway drug, that if, you know, that they see dispensaries as no different than a methadone clinic, that people are getting their methadone, walking out and selling it on the street. I mean, it's just not true. But my concern is, until you have a real generational shift away from some of the older people in Senate, I just think you're gonna be stuck in this going nowhere pattern. Because, you know, a lot of them still, you know, are the war on drugs generation. I mean, I grew up in that generation. Yeah. It failed.
Within Congress, we could say there's a couple of things that I've been talking about. Green State reported on this, that there was a recent act that Senator Rand Paul put out, the Hemp Economic Mobilization Plan Act, the Hemp Act, tripling the allowed concentration of Delta 9 THC in hemp crops. So there's one thing you got there. But at the same time, we also have setbacks because you have a House committee also approving a spending bill containing provisions prohibiting most consumable cannabinoid products, despite them being federally legalized during the first Trump administration. So there's all this here that, I mean, if we're going to have to rely on Congress to go ahead and move forward on this, you know, it's just the same thing goes. Government really just gets in the way of all this, and it's unfortunate.
It does, and as I've said before, you know, if all 50 states, I mean, I know it's a stretch to say Idaho, maybe, comes forward with some true cannabis reform, you know, maybe if federal laws become somewhat irrelevant, but sadly, you know, I don't know if that would happen because 288, I mean, I think that's really, if that went away, so much of the industry would go away, would be troubles with the industry would go away, such as getting publicly listed on a and traded on a U.S. market, so you don't have to be in Canada, such as, you know, greater opportunities in the financial sector, which, again, you know, being able to be public traded, it's, for example, I mean, just there's so many things that could improve. And I always want to be an optimist, but I think we have to be a realist at the same time.
Yep. And think about it like this. In the overall space and the scope of right now cannabis in the U.S., 40 of 50 states already have medical use locked in, 24 states for recreational. So we're already at 50% for adult use now. You know, I mean.
And the federal government doesn't get it.
Yeah, if the public ground school doesn't show, I don't know what else we can budge them, except, of course, the lobbying money, which cannabis right now, you know, when you have states like California and you can't make that kind of money, I'm sure these companies, if they're willing to go ahead and put some lobbying money together to outbid big pharma, and even with the help of alcohol and tobacco, they can't get over the finish line, can't get anything close to sway these policymakers any farther either. So, you know, we're going to continue to be in the same quagmire for the duration, but we'll be here about it. We'll talk about it again, I'm sure.
I'm sure. Hopefully it won't be 7 years before we talk again, but hopefully there'll be some real reform coming sooner than later, because otherwise the industry just continues to struggle.
So again, Josh, I really appreciate you joining me here. Joshua Horn, attorney at Fox Rothschild, the co-chair of the cannabis law practice. Website is foxrothschild.com, FOXROTHSCHILD. And real quickly, if you can, you know, inform the audience for those that might be interested in the cannabis space that would like to go ahead and inquire about your services, go ahead and tell people about what you were able to go and provide in terms of services and why they should go ahead and come to your team.
Sure. Well, Fox Rothschild is a full service law firm. We have offices, every 30 offices around the country. And I think just about every office, we have somebody touching the cannabis space. And so, you know, we do everything in cannabis that somebody would do in traditional businesses. I mean, from forming companies, tax advice, to IP, to regulatory, to litigation, to M&A, to finance. And we do everything in cannabis that any other law firm would do in the traditional space of representing a furniture manufacturing company. So we've been doing it since 2016. As Jorge mentioned, we're Chambers ranked, the first Chambers ranked. I've been Chambers ranked. So, you know, we can really help you if you have the need, and we do work and have been traditional cannabis.
Joshua, I really appreciate you taking time out. Thanks for joining me here on Blunt Business, and we'll get back to this once again. Just really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And thank you, listeners, as always, for listening to Blunt Business. We will talk to you next time.